working on it. Well, Sinatra. Okay, James Joyce and Sinatra. Doesn't every station have that? Yeah, right. WBAI is a unique. And if we do not save it, you will miss it. How often have you heard that? Many times. But it's dire. It really is. I am absolutely honest when I tell you that I often wake up mornings with anxiety. I started here when I was 13. I've done little else with my life. I dropped out of high school to be at WBAI and haven't gone back, by the way. Never got past the ninth grade. Anyway.
You didn't miss much.
Yeah, right. Well, it was the 60s, man. It was the thing to do, was drop out. People see the photographs of me in those days. You'll understand. Very, very wide pupils. I don't mean the pupils in class. Anyway. It's serious. Which is why I want you all in unison. No, that won't work. There aren't that many people to answer the phone. Serially. All one at a time.
Stagger
over to your phone. Pick up your phone and dial area code 212-209-2950 and say, I was told that I have to pledge money. I will give you all my money. Oh, no, that's Scientology. Sorry. No, it's I will give you... Let's say $25, okay? Or better yet, $10. $10 a month. Become a WBAI buddy. That's 10 bucks a month. 10 clams a month. And we are still giving away for that as a thank you gift. For $50 for new members, you can get Pacifica on a stick. I know many people would like to do that. But there's... which is referring to a thumb drive. But if you become a BAI buddy, you will get, if I'm reading this correctly, two thumb drives, each one's stock filled with historic programs from WBAI and Pacifica Radio through the years, from covering the Freedom March of 50 years ago to some of the most amazing audio that you can imagine, including, by the way, some pretty darn good science fiction radio drama, something that we here at BAI never stopped doing. And we're going to talk about that more next week. When we present The Star Pit by Samuel R. Delaney, starting at midnight. So, 1967 production, won the Nebula Award. So, 212-209-2950. Please call and pledge now. Initially, I was assigned to raise $700. And when I asked, by the way, I've been trying to... shall we say, negotiate for a better time slot. And the answer that I get is, Jim, you're not raising enough money. BS. When I was on Hour of the Wolf, during the Hour of the Wolf, you know, in the twilight of the morning, could easily raise over $1,000. I had a regular listenership. I had a good thing going. Somebody started mucking around with the programming schedule, and I think that mucking is a good idea, but that person totally mucked up and left WBAI before they could take it. You know, there's like a three-stage plan, and that, you know, plan number one was to start moving some programs around. Plan number two was to make more space. Plan number three was to build a new schedule. We never got to part two of that plan. And in essence, Hour of the Wolf was canceled. And thanks to Robert Knight donating a half an hour of his airtime, he was on Midnight to Two with Earth Watch, the recently deceased Robert Knight, I should mention. And the canceling of a program, a recorded program, that was on from 2 to 3 in the morning, I was sort of inserted here and feel like I'm in limbo. And now I'm told, Jim, you're not raising the money. Well, This is like when a network station moves a program into a time slot that nobody will ever watch, and then they cancel the show for lack of viewership. To which one says, duh. So, even though I spoke to the station manager earlier today and said, you can't raise money at that hour, I'd like to prove that wrong. Okay? I believe that that we can do better. I believe that WBAI can do better. But I don't think that we're even going to survive to do better if you don't call and pledge. 212-209-2950. Pledge $10. Say you'd like to become a WBAI buddy, and you can do so in the name of Hour of the Wolf. Or you can go to the website, WBAI.org. I'm not going to tell you to do that give to WBAI thing, because that Earl is just too weird. Give, then the number 2, WBAI. It's like, forget it. Just go to WBAI.org and follow. I promise you, you're going to see a thing that says, click here to pledge. We're not turning down that opportunity when we bring people to the website, all right? 212-209-2950, or go to the website and in the drop-down menu, choose Hour of the Wolf as the reason that you are pledging. Please do so now. Okay, I'm quite done with the pitching. It's 1:30, and I believe that's fulfilled. I should probably play a cut of music.
Why not?
Yeah, to freshen up the sounds. I have to finish. Oh, I am logged in. Okay. I depend on the computer primarily for my music nowadays, because I have legal streaming capabilities.
You must play Kraftwerk.
Why did the screen just blank? It was because you said Kraftwerk.
Yeah, that's it.
And the computer's going bon 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 with the autobahn, and it just at that point, Win7 just freaks out when it hears that. Or actually, it's Windows 2000. What the? No, I don't want. Oh, boy, do I not want Oracle, Java Auto Updater to make changes to this computer. And don't you let it either at home. Don't do this at home. What is going on here?
Okay. All I'm ever doing is updating my software.
Yeah, okay. Let's go away, that little pop-up down there. Okay, I know what song I want to play because Dan and I... We're talking about it outside before, and it's a favorite song of mine. Oh, but that's not the title. I remember the title of the song.
Celluloid.
Is that it, or is it Everybody's a Star?
I thought
it
was.
No, you're right. It's Celluloid Heroes.
Yes.
Celluloid. That should be enough, you'd think, right? There's a band called Celluloid?
Of course there is.
Yeah, that figures, doesn't it? Okay, no, I don't want... No, this is the song. This is the song. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Down the boulevard. fragile. That's why she tried to be so hard. But they turned her into a princess, and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom, because she wanted to be alone. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood. And some who suffered in vain. Rudolph Valentino looks very much alive, and he looks up ladies' dresses as they sadly pass him by. Avoid stepping on Bela Lugosi, 'cause he's liable to turn and bite. Such a lonely life. If you covered him with garbage, George Saunders would still have style. And if you stamped on Mickey Rooney, he would still turn round and smile. But please don't tread on dearest Marilyn, 'cause she's not very tough. She should have been made. She was only made of flesh and blood. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you hardly even heard of. People who worked and suffered and struggled for fame. Suffered in vain. Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in showbiz. It doesn't matter who you are. And those who are successful, be always on your guard. Success walks hand in hand along Hollywood Boulevard. I wish my life was a non-stop Hollywood movie show, a fantasy world of celluloid villains and heroes. Because celluloid heroes never feel any. Celluloid heroes never feel any pain. I'm celluloid heroes never.
if Turner Classic Movies ever chooses to have an anthem, it should be a variant on that.
Too hip.
No, no, no.
For Turner,
No. I mean, you know, look, they're moving along with the times in some ways. I mean, their Friday night stuff when they started the Friday night spotlights, and the first the host for the first month was Ileana Douglas.
Mm.
You know, you don't get much hipper. Yeah. I think, than her. I mean, yeah, sometimes the stuff on TCM just looks like, yes, we're trying to get money out of the old farts. you know, when you see all the stuff for the cruises and stuff like that. Yeah. But on the other hand, but still, Robert Osborne is a classic. But Ben Mankiewicz is very good.
Yeah.
I don't
watch a lot of TCM stuff.
Oh, you see, that's when my TV goes on.
Yeah.
That's the home channel. That's the channel that comes on. And that's what I watch, are the, you know. And then I'll make sure that there's nothing I need to record on Channel 13, because twice a year maybe there will be. And then I check what's on the movie channels, and I probably will watch something on the Roku instead. that's where.
Netflix.
Well, Netflix, movie. But also I've become very, very fond. My second favorite subscription channel is Acorn.
The British.
It's mostly
BBC stuff.
ITV, BBC, and the IBC.
Oh, okay.
Don't forget the IBC.
Oh, yeah.
Because one of my favorite shows there, which PBS has finally picked up, and only on Channel 21, not on 13, is Miss Fisher's Mysteries, which is a flapper. An Australian flapper of the 1920s solving murders in high form, and usually she finds a boy or two to take home each episode, and she doesn't seem totally restricted to that either. Mm-hmm. It's very offbeat, very strong. You definitely need the subtitles, the closed captioning turned on to in order to watch that and Rake. Now Rake is actually on Netflix, and they're going to do an American version of it, and God knows how they're going to be able to pull that one off, because I think it's network. It's not like going to be FX or HBO or something where they try to get away with bleep. This show uses nudity and language. Well, not so much nudity, but language. The language. The title says it all. It's a lawyer. He's a rake.
Mm-hmm.
Or a rake.
Oh, wait a minute. Rake. They've already done it. Yeah. It ran a few months ago. Who was it who was...
Was it like Gabriel Byrne or something?
I don't think it was Gabriel Byrne. It was...
It's Richard Roxburgh in Australia.
Yeah. It was... I want to say it was the guy who used to host Talk Soup on...
Greg Kinnear.
I think it was
Kinnear.
Greg Kinnear.
He would be good in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, this is really like an unredeeming...
Yeah,
I think I tried to watch
an episode. I'm not even sure I got all the way through the episode.
See the Australian one,
yeah.
Which is has done two seasons and will do a third.
Right.
Also, Miss Fisher's Mysteries, but Rake is actually on Netflix, whereas Miss Fisher's Mysteries, it's now on Channel 21. But some good Australian crime. Dramas, but not only, so Acorn actually has a lot of English-speaking programs from other countries. The Brief is a very good lawyer show, starring Alan Davis, Davies, but I've learned that in Brit-ese, Davies, what would be Davies here, is Davis. It's just Davis.
They're always doing that to us.
Like Russell Davis of Torchwood and Doctor Who.
I think it's Davies. I think it's a deliberate effort to embarrass us.
Yeah, if only they could speak American. They doesn't know.
American.
Yeah. Well, that would be Midwest. Although Martin Freeman did such a good job with his Minnesotan accent.
Yeah. You're talking about Fargo?
Well, duh.
Yeah.
Which has just been renewed.
Which is good. I was watching
with an
it.
All new cast.
The first, and particularly with Martin Freeman, the development of his character and the path his character took in that show was pretty amazing. Because you thought it was going to be the William H. Macy, character.
Well, and people assumed that with Alison Tolman, the lead. No, this is not March.
Yeah.
This is although they pull a fast one on you near the end of the series where she almost turns into March.
Yeah.
But she doesn't. But then her father, Keith Carradine, and Bob Odenkirk, and all these wonderful performers.
It was an interesting way of carrying on the spirit of the show. I had seen the promos, and I had gone, oh, no, because the promos sort of emphasize sort of the broad weirdness.
Which it certainly had.
Which it did have, but it was keeping with the tone of what the Coen brothers had come up with.
Without doing it.
Yeah.
Without doing
without,
it. There's
without
only
without
one,
recapitulating.
There's only one element from the movie that's in the TV show.
Fargo shows up as, and here again, same as in the movie, Fargo isn't the actual location.
Right, but that's not it. No, there is
the Paul Bunyan statue, I think, does show up.
Is that in the movie?
It is in the movie. It's very definitely in the movie.
So I guess there's a scene from Bemidji, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of Coen Brothers winks. I saw a bit from Barton Fink in...
Yeah.
Fargo and the TV series and all that. But there's an actual important part of the movie that is in the TV show.
I'll probably know what it is when you tell me.
The suitcase.
Yes, of course, the suitcase, yes.
The suitcase. Yeah. I mean, that's just... It's the one thing, that's a complete... Right. Did you see the whole show?
Yeah, I did.
I mean, the performances in there. I mean, I always thought Billy Bob Thornton was great, but it's conceivable that his characterization of Lorne Malvo may be one of his best performances ever.
I would not argue with that. I thought he was very good.
Talk about the quality of performances on a TV series in this manner, and the writing and the arc and all that.
Well, as far as at least what we're calling basic cable now, and particularly channels like AMC and FX, the quality both in terms of the filmmaking and the performances, not across the board, but certainly with a great number of series, those have gone up fantastically.
But I remember when Bravo was good and A&E were good, and those are both down the toilet.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, there was a time you could turn on A&E, and they would go on the air at 4 o'clock. Right. They weren't on. They were blank from about 2 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Right.
4 p.m.
Right.
And I turned it on at 4 p.m. one day, and there was a two-hour special with Peter Shkreli.
Yeah.
Out of the blue. Yeah. And I've never seen that particular thing anywhere.
Back when A&E was about arts
and entertainment. What a concept.
Yeah.
And was mostly it was non-commercial. They didn't run ads.
Yeah.
They didn't run, or if they did, it was only between shows.
Yeah, that's right.
But they wouldn't interrupt a show.
It was born out of, do you remember the CBS cable network?
Right.
That's what A&E was born out of.
That's right. I'd forgotten that.
Right. And so, and CBS was a genuine attempt to do an arts television network.
Yeah.
Bravo was supposed to be that, too.
And Ovation.
And Ovation.
And Ovation still sort of they're so limited.
Yeah.
They're so limited. Anyhow, why don't you say who you is? I mean, people hear your reviews. But the people just tuning in.
Right. I am Dan Persons. I am a movie reviewer and a journalist for Cinefantastique.
Going back to originally when?
Going back to 1987.
That late? I thought it was earlier.
No. It was round about 1987.
When did Cine Fantastic begin publication?
Cine Fantastic, oh boy.
Because I remember reading it before.
It began in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Somewhere around
then. That is my recollection.
Yeah, somewhere around then.
Good magazine.
An excellent magazine. It started off as a mimeographed newsletter.
Founded almost a fanzine.
By Fred Clark. Very much a fanzine. But as opposed to the typical type of fanzine type writing, the type of writing where it's more about enthusiasm than actual literary skill.
That's how fanzines began. Yeah. I mean, the first... outside of science fiction fandom and baseball fandom, the first real fanzines of the modern era was Crawdaddy with Paul Williams.
Yeah.
Not the rock star, but the writer, the one who put Philip K. Dick in the name of every Hollywood producer's lips by saying in Rolling Stone, what was it, the greatest... sci-fi brain on any planet, something like that. Mm-hmm. And from that, Blade Runner was born.
But Cine Fantastique was born out of the idea of Fred Clark, and it was essentially forged in the time of Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate. And what Fred Clark's goal was to elevate the science fiction fan magazine, elevated above what they were doing in things like Famous Monsters.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Filmland.
Famous Monsters of Filmland, Forrest J. Ackerman, in the 1950s was the magazine that coined the word sci-fi because it specifically was not about science fiction. And Forrest Ackerman knew that, so he coined the term. I don't know if he invented it, but he coined it.
It's usually attributed to Forrest.
Yeah, he made it popular if he didn't make it up.
Yeah.
And that's the funny thing, is he didn't use it as a pejorative, but he certainly meant to distinguish it from SF. That SF and sci-fi were two different things. And sci-fi was about the kind of stuff that you found in Famous Monsters of Filmland, which I guess is the first semi-prozine.
Yeah, it is. And it's a generally beloved magazine, and it was landmark in its time. What Fred Clark wanted to do was...
Fred Clark is post-2001.
Space Odyssey. Yeah, 2001.
Sorry, I should have qualified that.
Yes, that's true.
In the early 70s, he was post-2001 in a couple of ways.
Yeah. And in the same way that 2001 elevated the art of science fiction storytelling in film, Fred Clark wanted to elevate the critical appreciation and critical writing of science fiction film. And that's what Cine Fantastique started out as, was essentially a critical journal.
Because what had really happened is when you say, oh, I'm involved in science fiction, before 2001 A Space Odyssey, or before Star Trek, more to the point, people would say, oh, that Buck Rogers stuff.
Yeah.
And then it became that Star Trek stuff. But with Cine Fantastique, all of a sudden, as science fiction was beginning to elevate with things like Dangerous Visions and the new wave in science fiction, so Cine Fantastique was bringing to the mainstream American public the idea that science fiction cinema was not a ghetto of monsters.
It was a serious art to be discussed and appreciated.
Yeah, which is funny that it had fallen into that ghetto when you consider that it's largely science fiction cinema that launched movies to begin with. George Méliès, anybody?
Méliès.
And I thought it was Méliès, actually.
I don't count on my pronunciations of foreign names.
Georges Méliès, I believe. Yeah. And, you know, Fritz. Now, I say Lang, but there are film critics, you know, the cognoscenti that say Lang. But too many people. I've heard interviews with him where he called himself Lang.
I'll go with Fritz Lang.
And
If I turn out to be wrong, I shall sacrifice my my framed copy of Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night.
Yeah, and so it goes. Yes. But if I had to make a list, you know, of a top 10, which I would hate to do, mm-hmm. Metropolis must be there.
Metropolis is very high up there. 2001: A Space Odyssey would be up there. Metropolis is one of the landmark founding science fiction films.
Absolutely. Very, but it's definitely also a landmark film.
Yes.
And that was sort of my point, is that very often,
yeah,
films that are landmark films are science fiction.
True.
And something I don't think a lot of people think of or realize, that I think they're only starting to recognize that Avatar, for all of its problems as a story, as mm-hmm. in it didn't have one.
It had one. It was just a rather tired and not particularly entertaining story.
Right, but as a movie experience, yeah, it changed cinema.
Yeah.
As have other Cameron films, right, such as Titanic, for what it's worth.
It tends to be the genre film,
but
that changes filmmaking.
Gravity.
Certainly, we can... Gravity. We may as well cite as well Star Wars.
Absolutely.
As changing, you know.
In fact, if one had to go through the years, it would be, I think, A Trip to the Moon, Méliès, mm-hmm. Metropolis. Then there's really like 20 years or so, or even longer.
Well, there are films
until
like...
Until Forbidden Planet.
Things to Come.
Yes.
William Cameron Menzies as director, H.G. Wells
as screenwriter.
Yeah. Things to Come.
But Menzies is really... He gives that movie such a look,
yeah,
and such a feeling to it. I mean, some of it is old hat today, but it's still so worth watching.
It's a fantastic looking film. The effects and particularly the envisioning of technology doesn't quite cut it in terms of today, but you know.
But you know, given its time, given its year, and what it did for cinema,
yeah.
Because this was seen as a major movie. Again, this was not just a science fiction film. This was a mainstream mm-hmm. London Films, Alexander Korda producing and all that. So, yes, Things to Come. But then, really, how much else is there until Forbidden Planet?
Well, War of the Worlds antedated Forbidden Planet.
But I wouldn't consider that as game-changing.
Yeah, but I would agree with you that... two films, actually. I think they were from the same year, actually. Forbidden Planet and Day the Earth Stood Still.
Okay, but even then, Day the Earth Stood Still was seen... Esperanto became a part of the language for a short period of time. And it certainly had mainstream actors in it.
Yeah.
Patricia Neal. Yeah. Not Michael Rennie. He was a genre actor.
The thing to know about both Forbidden Planet and Day the Earth Stood Still, the things that sort of separated them at the time were that they were prestige productions from major studios.
Exactly. And then, after the Day the Earth Stood Still... and Forbidden Planet, again, we've got to jump ahead. I think we won't classify Dr. Strangelove as science fiction necessarily.
It walks the edge.
Walks the line.
When we were doing a 50th anniversary thing on CineFantastic, on the CineFantastic podcast, Dr. Strangelove was one of the first things this year that we did. We do sort of granted the privilege of being considered.
Technically speaking, it is.
Yeah.
But in terms of its intent, I don't think Kubrick was thinking of that.
Mm-hmm. Although, actually, the original one of the original scripts had a framing device that set up the actual film of Dr. Strangelove as being produced by aliens to depict what had happened on Earth.
I had no idea. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's certainly not in the book.
No.
The horrible book, that is.
The book was a serious, straightforward treatment of what Kubrick and Peter Sellers and Terry Southern turned into farce.
Right. Right. And what was the other movie that was based on the same book?
Failsafe.
Failsafe was its own novel.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Red Alert was the name of the book.
Red Alert was the name of the book, right.
And from that came Strangelove and a more serious film. Failsafe is genius. Failsafe is great.
It's been a long time since I've seen
it. Did you see the live television version?
No.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That must be available somewhere.
It's probably
it was performed live twice, once for the East Coast and once for the West Coast, produced by and starring George Clooney.
Hmm.
And, yes, Clooney, having left television, making some miserable movies.
The more recent...
Specifically
Batman. Oh, yeah, that's right. There was a recent live version of Failsafe. I forgot about that.
And after Batman, he said, okay, stop. This is going nowhere.
Yeah.
Let's pull back. And he did...
Good night.
The thing that he pulled off on once on ER, which he did a live episode of ER.
Yeah, right.
And he did that again with a live
version.
Television version done twice, once for each coast of Failsafe. Live performance. I mean, that's guts.
Yeah.
That really is. Yeah. And it was good, too. It was very good. The movie still is, ranks better, but you've got to give Clooney creds for having done that. But at any rate, so then comes 2001.
Right.
Then jump forward and Star Wars.
Star Wars is the next
game changer.
Next
Close
game
Encounters,
changer.
Not as much.
Right.
But same era as Star Wars.
Yeah, and Close Encounters was sort of concurrent with Star Wars.
But it wasn't the same kind of game changer.
It wasn't the same kind. No, not at all.
Not at all. People are still imitating, including J.J. Abrams, trying to imitate Star Wars.
Basically, what Spielberg did that essentially set the table for Star Wars was Jaws.
Yes.
That was the film that introduced the summer blockbuster.
Right.
And then Star Wars sort of set what a summer... what defined exactly what a summer blockbuster was.
Yeah. Really was. Although, I think, actually, there are those who say The Godfather predates Jaws as a blockbuster. But wasn't that in the winter?
I believe...
Or autumn?
It was something like that.
So it wasn't a summer blockbuster, but it was one of the first round-the-block...
And I may not be remembering this correctly, but I do think Godfather followed Jaws.
So what follows Star Wars? As a game changer.
I want to say Jurassic Park as the next step.
It's a fine movie, but is it a game changer?
I think because of Jurassic Park was the thing that introduced, really introduced CG special effects into the mix. And I do think that...
You don't think that Industrial Light and Magic already did that with Star Wars and Empire?
That wasn't CG.
No, it was mostly practical.
It was all practical. And what we're talking about
Star Wars had CG.
Yeah, the original... No, when Lucas started tampering with it.
Yeah,
let's not talk about that. Let's Han shot first, okay?
Yes, okay. Okay, yeah, you're thinking, yeah, listener, you can come in any time, for Christ's sake. Guy's looking through the wall, as all the radio listeners can tell.
People, what is this, Grand Central Station?
No, the sound would be better.
Yeah, better acoustics.
Sorry. I have my rim shot over here in my bag.
We're waiting for the rim shot? Thank you.
There we go. Yes.
Okay.
How
hot is it?
Yeah, but you're thinking it's so hot. Whoops. I remember. I mean, the classic Johnny Carson one. It's so hot that the fire hydrants are flagging down dogs.
Yes.
It's yeah.
Let's move on. You know, we were talking about this. I think while Celluloid Heroes was playing, we were talking about probably Avatar.
Well, Avatar, Avatar, absolutely. I think more so than Jurassic Park.
I bristle at that being an advance of any type.
But it is. It's not a great movie, but it was a great experience. To go to that theater and experience the animation, it was like going seeing Captain EO or something at Disneyland. Yeah. You had that amazing experience, which was great until you left the theater. The moment you, left the theater, you were left with a mouthful of cotton candy.
The thing is, at least for me, I wasn't even feeling the experience while I was in there. And...
I very much did.
Just to be clear about it, I happen to respect James Cameron as a really great action film director.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's one of the
best.
And
if you want to talk about game changers, Terminator.
Terminator. Well, not Terminator, but Terminator 2 would be.
Now we're getting into the argument. The difference is that Terminator is a low-budget film.
Terminator is a low-budget film, and I would say Terminator is
the better
film.
Yes.
Yes.
I would agree with that. Terminator 2 is the bigger landmark.
Yeah.
But Terminator is the better movie.
Yeah.
But I think it goes out to prove something. And you know, the John Carpenter Dark Star point that you can do something on low budget, and there have been a lot of good movies on low budget. But just going forth with this,
I would also throw in between Star Wars and Avatar. I would throw in another film out of left field, which would be Batman.
Yes, I totally agree. And that was another major blockbuster. That was one of the first times again. That was the first time that people went around the block for a comic book movie and a comic book hero. And, you know, I prefer the comedy, happy, silly version that Tim Burton brought to the screen over the dour Chris Nolan thing.
I
like Batman Begins.
Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, I think, both are good movies. I think
The first 2 hours are fine.
And then the remaining 5 hours.
And then the remaining 40 minutes, you know, basically after the Joker dies, we're totally into the Two-Face story, which had no place in there whatsoever. The movie should end.
Right.
With Heath Ledger saying bye-bye in that film.
Joker didn't die, by the way.
Once he's shuffled off stage. Yeah, and I loved, by the way they did that in Tim Burton's Batman.
Mm-hmm.
That he dies, but then there's like the laughing.
Yeah, the
teeth,
little laughing, laughing
letting
box,
us know. Yeah, there's room. There's room. But you know, Chris Nolan did a lot of decent, interesting things, but I think that Batman Begins is the better the best of the trilogy.
I will say this is that, well, Dark Knight Rises, I think,
has its moments, but it's way overlong.
It's overlong. It's my take on it has always been, well, why do you want to spend time with boring old Batman when you can watch Bruce Wayne and his Afghani chiropractor?
Yes, right. Yeah, you know. Basically.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know,
the problem is that Batman as another game changer.
Right. Right.
And so
it's still too early to say. I would like to say that Gravity is going to be a game changer, but I'm not sure.
I think it has won its place on the as has Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Because what Lord of the Rings and Gravity have both done, something that major movies before that, including Star Wars and 2001, did not do, is it was nominated for major Academy Awards outside of the special effects field.
And these are movies. Lord of the Rings actually.
Lord of the Rings is the first.
Actually won best. And let me just say that they gave the Oscar to Return of the King.
Yeah.
The Oscar was actually going to the Lord of the Rings.
That's correct.
And it sort of bothers me about that, but
can we
can't
give a Razzie to The Hobbit? Can we give a Razzie?
you should.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to do so right now, or better yet, wait. Now you've heard all the sound effects this thing does. It's got an applause, crickets, rimshot, and boo. And the person who gave it to me had no doubt that it was intended for the air. I've had it since December, but I've withstood. I carry it in my bag, and at the wrong moments, I lean against the bag, you know, and I could be in just totally inappropriate moment. It starts applauding or...
You butt sound effect.
Yes, basically.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think Gravity is a game changer. I really do.
I am hoping it is. The question
I will
is going
continue,
to be
and this will be a point of dispute between you and I, but we've already done this one on the air, that in terms of the better science fiction movie, as science fiction itself, I go for Her.
Yeah, I understand that a lot of people feel that way. I can understand why they feel that way. It is a science
Certainly
fiction film.
Certainly from a mainstream point of view.
From a mainstream point of view, not a lot of mainstream people went to see Her. But
it nevertheless won the Academy Award.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. It was nominated for Best Picture, and it won Best Screenplay.
I respect the film for its approach. I respect it in particular for the performances.
You liked
in the film.
It. I loved it.
I liked the film. I did not love
let's not,
it. I
let's
do
not
have
make it
problems.
Seem like you didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah. I did like it. I do have serious problems, and I have this problem consistently, I think, with Spike Jonze and the way he approaches stories and what he wants to get across.
Now, how many films has he written?
He hasn't written any film, but he is the director.
He wrote John Malkovich.
He did not write John Malkovich.
Of course
Charlie
not.
Kaufman.
Of course,
that was
Charlie Kaufman.
Kaufman.
Yeah.
No.
They're a great team up, aren't they? Kaufman and Jonze. No.
I had problems with being John Malkovich. I had problems with adaptation.
Yeah, I had some issues with both, including the fact that in each of those films, the characters are so dark and so sour, you cannot root for anybody in either of those films.
That's the thing.
There isn't
and,
a protagonist.
And I feel in the way they do that with those characters, there's a certain blandishment of the audience that sits wrong with me. Mm-hmm. The way those characters are, it's like Spike Jonze is saying to the audience, look at you, you're sitting here watching this marvelous piece of art rather than going to the dreck with all of the rabble. I was perfectly fine with adaptation up to the point where it does the twist where it turns into the Robert McKee film.
Yeah.
And then that was the point I said, you didn't have to do that. I can understand why they're doing that, but I did not appreciate them doing it.
Yeah. And my problem with Malkovich is that I loved it when I saw it, and because it was very innovative, and there was very clever stuff going on in there. But it's like, you know, the Cusack, the John Cusack character is horrid. The Cameron Diaz character is horrid.
And
the only person who isn't totally horrid is Malkovich. And even he has issues.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Because he was playing himself.
And here again.
By the way, Crossbones is a lot of fun. I'm up to episode 4.
Oh, okay.
It's coming to the U.S. in September.
The John Cusack character is styled as this Philistine, essentially.
Yes.
Whose estimation of himself is much higher than he actually is. And here again, it's this blandishment.
Yes.
Of the audience.
So that's the Kaufman end of it.
Yeah.
But the Jones thing in her, I have a theory, but let's not do this all morning because we've done this one.
I will do a side note here if just to get it off my chest because this amazed me.
I will bring her back to the airwaves because I've been writing an essay.
Okay.
But sorry, go on.
When Being John Malkovich came out, I did the roundtables, the press roundtables, where we interviewed a lot of the stars of the film and Spike Jonze. You want to know who are huge people, seriously, physically? John Cusack and John Malkovich.
I knew who Malkovich was. I had no idea that Cusack was a big guy.
When you see him on screen, he doesn't act it.
That's brilliant.
It absolutely is.
That tells you how good an actor he is.
Yeah. He came into the room, and I was like, holy bleep.
You know? Yeah, holy number one.
Holy number
one. See that list over there? What I usually do is I just say, I don't give a three about that. Person is a bona fide number six.
By the way, you know, the problem with this list, by the way, at least as it is now, is that we could say it's number thing on George Carlin's.
Yeah, but George,
but it's not.
But
it's the wrong order.
It's the wrong order. The Carlin list is not the FCC list.
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, the FCC doesn't proscribe any words. They just proscribe things that are, quote, indecent.
Yeah.
And I wish I could give my favorite Carlin quote on the air, which doesn't invoke any of those words.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give the first half of it, is you can prick your finger.
Yeah, but you can't.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
By the way, for anybody listening on this list, if you know the Carlin routine, it's only the first two items that are reversed here.
Yes.
So
that are dyslexic, yes.
Yeah.
But since that's the one in front of us, mistakenly, that's the one I use.
Yeah.
And even then, and according to WBAI's or Pacifica's lawyers, at this hour, I can use those words.
Genie is out of the bottle now.
If I invoke safe harbor, which is to say I would have to do a disclaimer, I would, you know... And this is something that we used to do all the time. And on some old programs, I used to say, the following program contains Frank Heller. If you are offended by Frank Heller, please tune out and rejoin us when he won't be on the air. But
well, having now done that, let me just say that a guy entered an agent's office and said, I have this wonderful act for you. It's a family act. I'm not going to continue it. No.
Aristocrats.
The Aristocrats.
There's a whole movie.
Yeah.
And it's a boring film.
Oh, I loved it.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah, some people did.
Yeah.
I just, you know, sat there and it's like, okay, Billy Crystal, yeah, yeah, Whoopi for Whoopi, you know.
Well, but Billy Crystal isn't the only, and some of them, Bob Saget won.
Yeah, he was good. Gilbert Gottfried was amazing in that.
Yeah.
But it's a one-joke movie, literally. Literally.
The other anecdote, let me give you another anecdote, because I interviewed Gilbert Gottfried for The Aristocrats, and I said, you know, it was for a podcast, and I said, okay, what we'll do is I'll talk to you regular, and then if you want to do the character, Gilbert Gottfried character, you can then do the character, and we'll do that. And he said, oh, I never talk out of character. And so we did the entire interview with the Gilbert Gottfried character.
Yeah. I once saw Tiny Tim out of character. In an airport.
And he talks like this.
No, he was just talking, but he had the purple hair. I mean, there's no mistaking the guy.
I bet he had him. Probably had a beautiful voice, even when he wasn't doing.
Wouldn't be surprised. The Jim Neighbors thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
So you had a bone to pick with me about gore.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
And we're not talking about Al.
No, we're not talking about Al Gore. That's another bone to pick. He lost that election. But in any case, a few weeks ago, I did my review of Snowpiercer, the Hong Kong, Hong Kong derived film by the Korean director Bong Joon-ho, and I had some
problems.
Which
sounds like brilliant science fiction.
It's an interesting film. I did have some problems with it in terms of the pacing and how he sort of balanced out the dramatic sequences with the more action oriented sequences, that sort of thing. The pacing of the film, and afterwards. You got on and you added a little addendum about your own feelings about the film,
which I've not seen and will not see.
Yeah, well, and this is where we get into it. But I listened to your comments, and
is funny because from all indications, that's a good movie.
A lot of people like it. I haven't seen a really bad
review that disliked it.
No, and. That's fair. I think it's a good film.
I do think
it's a good film. It's not a bad film. I came into it with high hopes. I came out of it saying, you know, it was a worthwhile experience for me. I just had some problems with it.
Well, the problem that I had.
Well,
okay, go ahead.
Yeah, let me go ahead, because I did copy this down, and when I heard you say it, I said, aha, spanking time. What
number one, I'm not going near that. Number two, I'm not going near that.
Yeah, okay. I copied down what you said.
Bring out the sound effect again.
What you had said to start off with was what you just said here, is that, you know, I heard it, you know, it's gotten very good reviews. I'm not going to hear it. I'm not going to see it. And this is you. This is your quote. The reason why you said you weren't going to see it is, quote, the film is gory. The film has what I call gornography, okay?
Okay, and you know, actually, I will back that up. I will back up that statement.
Okay, let me just jump a little ahead. Let's do a little ellipses. The other quote from that just a few seconds after was, and this is relating to the gore, all the gore in the film, don't do that, people. Don't do that. There is no ... It doesn't advance your story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll stand by that statement also.
I'll
defend it.
Unless this is what the filmmaker, the director, felt he needed to do advance his story. He's the director. The director is the auteur of the film.
Don't care. Let me make a statement here, and let me make a strong statement.
Okay.
It's one thing when you pull the curtain shade, or a couple of people start kissing, and the camera moves up, it gauzes over, the curtain goes down. It's another thing when you see genitalia. That turns from a love scene into pornography. It's something for a person to get run through in a sword in a movie, in Robin Hood, get hit with an arrow. It's another thing when in Game of Thrones we see arterial spurting and some somebody's eye actually, you know, spurt close up on camera. It's the same thing. From the difference between love scene and porn, and from violence to pornography.
Okay.
No, it doesn't advance the story, because that same thing could occur without showing the visceral gore and guts.
Unless the director wants to do that.
And the director may want to make porn.
Well, then, it, okay.
Right? Francois Truffaut could have put porn in any of his films, and he would have loved it.
Let me just say
Cocteau
a couple of things.
Cocteau certainly would.
Yeah.
Godard. Thank you. Not Cocteau. Yeah. Anything but yeah. Cocteau. Yeah. Godard. I just watched Beauty and the Beast again, so I had Cocteau on the brain, as
Cocteau.
It were.
Not Cocteau.
Not Cocteau.
Beautiful.
Right.
Thing.
Oh, God.
But, okay. Here is the thing. As far as I'm concerned, okay, it's one thing if you don't like gore. A few seconds after
it's
that,
it's just a question of not liking.
No. Well, let me just say this, yeah. Okay? Because a little later on, you said, you know, I don't want to see this film, and then stay up for years afterwards, yeah, having seen the film. I can understand that if you don't like the stuff.
It's
fine.
Not a question of not liking it. You see, you're missing the point.
No,
it has a visceral effect on the people who see it. The fact that this has been in cinema since the 80s, since the splatter movie era, and torture porn and all that, has changed the way people perceive violence.
First off, it's not just since the 80s. It has been with film since the very
beginning. It became a popular
thing. Always been. Film is a visual medium. Film is a visceral medium. The whole point of film, and I'm going to go all film school.
Okay, fine.
On you here.
So you're
going
to start with Enchant and Delou.
That certainly is one. But let me just say this.
And that's far more artistic than Friday the 13th, Part 9.
The whole point of film is to trigger an empathetic reaction in the audience through the visual medium. It's a visceral response to thing. And I feel that gore is as valid a tool, and sex, for that matter, is as valid a tool as any other.
But
in telling a film story. And let me just say, I'm not a gore hound. You know, I'm not one of these guys who you used to, like, page through Fangoria and go, pansies, you know. I'm not that type of person. And, you know, we're talking about, and it isn't that the fact that either the term of gornography, and by the way, did you coin that?
No, I got it from a British website.
Okay.
And I think it was, no, it wasn't a website. It was an article in The Guardian, and like 10 years ago, somebody used that, and I appropriated it from there. But as far as I know, I'm one of the few people that have been continually using the term, hoping to help coin it. I also try to coin the term trouble you. Like, if you want to go to a website, you go to treblew.wbai.org. And I stole that one, appropriated that one from Douglas Adams, who just threw that at me one time when I was talking with him off mic, you know, about something or other. And he said, oh, you know, my website is just at treblew.whatever. And I gave it back to him about 2 years later. And he said, oh, that's very clever. Where did you get that?
Yeah.
I thought, you damn well know where I got it. No, he had totally forgotten. Mm-hmm. He had just made it up on the spot when I picked up on it.
Well, it's also a nice coinage. It's sort of become moot because you no longer have to need it.
And by the way, everybody who does promos at WBAI and the like, there's no need for www dot.
Yeah.
No more need for that than there is to say http://. I mean, is it necessary for the web address? It is. And every browser ever made will put it in for you automatically without even showing it to you.
I want to get back to our heated argument, but before we do that, I just want to point out, you know, because you have tended to focus in on the fact that I do cfqonline.com.
Oh, and it's .org.
Yeah, it's not org. It's .com.
It is .com.
But, you know, I was thinking about it, and I realized where I got it?
Mm-hmm.
Back when David Letterman, back when the internet was new, David Letterman.
Not when the web was new.
When the web was new. David
Letterman wasn't on the air.
When the web was new, when David Letterman would have to give a URL on the air, he'd go like www.cbs.com.
Oh, is that very good?
That's where I got it.
Yeah.
So
George Carlin used to say, "My name, it never stops. G-E-O-R-G-E-O-R-E."
Yeah. Well, that's like, I forget, Rich Hall was the comedian who came up with
he was wonderful with words.
Sniglets, and yeah. one of them, which he said was his favorite, and it is a good one, he called banana nanity, which is the irrational fear that once you started spelling the word banana, you wouldn't be able to stop.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, back to Gore. Back to Gore is that, I was going to say that it isn't that the term gornography or the term torture porn are invalid terms. Those things do exist, you know. And if you want to talk a film that I think is actual gornography, it would be a film like Dead Alive, the old Peter Jackson zombie film, which is just sploosh all over the place.
Yeah, the only one I could ever watch was the one with the puppets.
Yeah.
And where instead of gore, it was feathers.
Yeah, I know, and it just sort of runs on a little too long.
It really does. Yeah. It would be great at 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's true of most Peter Jackson films.
It's very true. You know, and if you want to talk torture porn, certainly Hostile
is where I first encountered that phrase.
Yeah. And that's it. Although I do think that that film, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, I do think
there
that
people
film,
think it's a very clever satire.
I do think it is. As
I'm not
well.
Questioning
okay.
whether or not there's but intelligence in these things.
Here's the thing, is that what I am saying here is that film is intended to trigger visceral response, empathy, through the use of the visual medium.
Mm-hmm.
When you say something is, and this is my problem with sort of the broad usage of the terms like pornography and torture porn, what are you saying? You're basically accusing the film of doing what film is supposed to do anyway.
I disagree. I think a more skilled director wouldn't have to resort to it and could accomplish the exact same ends.
Let's put aside skill. Another director... Honestly, let's put it aside because there are skilled directors. There are directors who are genuine artists, and
Wes Craven is a genuine artist.
John Carpenter, who's one of the
progenitors of gore on camera.
Yeah. David Cronenberg.
Yeah, brilliant director.
Brilliant director who can use gore.
Who can also do the same thing without it. He's proven it.
Well, but that's
Scanners
that's
is
the
not
point.
Actually that gory, but it is as frightening, even with the exploding head thing. But there's no point during Scanners that I have to turn away. There's nothing in Scanners that that makes me go viscerally and gives me sleepless nights.
I think, you see, I think...
And there's the difference between Scanners and Game of Thrones.
Have you watched Game of Thrones?
Through episode 8. Okay. That's when I stopped. And I stopped very specifically when somebody was killed with a spear, and we have to watch how the spear enters the neck and is pulled out, and then something else goes on, and then we cut back to the neck where we see the artery and the arterial spouting of the blood, and the camera holds on that for about 10 seconds, so it goes gush, gush, gush. It was bad enough in MASH, where Robert Altman proves his point by, during an operation, a person is bleeding out. Mm. And there's even more gore in Catch-22, where the character's body just...
decapitated.
He's not decapitated. He's cut. Jack Guilford is cut in half by the plane.
Yeah,
that's laughable. Yeah. That's not it. It's the guy on the plane who bleeds out, whose body
That's right.
Explodes and the guts and the blood and there's no blood when Jack Guilford is cut in half.
Yeah. Save him! Save him! Save who?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that almost makes your point, but that is also taking it to the limit. There is a point, as there is a point between lovemaking and even nudity and what people call pornography, which I'm not, by the way, necessarily against. Pornography, if it gives me a sleepless night, at least I'll enjoy it. Gornography gives me sleepless nights, and they are and I wake up with anxiety. I don't feel good after having seen it. Now, if that's what it takes for a director to be able to make a point, they're not. What they really want is for people to say, did you see what he did there? That's boss.
But then what's wrong with that? That is the point.
What's wrong is it's inuring people. It's inuring people to great violence. And I'm sorry, but read up on this. Most of the world psychiatrists agree with me. The world has changed because of slasher films.
I don't agree with that. I do feel that
you find it out with the top scientists and sociologists.
What I feel is that people can make a distinction between sitting in an auditorium and watching something happening on screen and having a visceral reaction to it. And I'm not going to go to the point of saying that, you know, every time there's graphic gore on screen, it serves the purpose of, you know, dissuading the audience by showing them the reality of it. I understand, you know.
Oh, showing the reality of something else.
No, no.
That's not what they're doing.
That's not what they're doing. And
they're writing the plots in order to get to those payoff moments.
And why not? Why not?
Because it's not good entertainment.
I would argue with you on that.
Not that I would name Max Schmid, but Max Schmid, for example, of WBAI, who will remain nameless. Max Schmid, producer of the Golden Age of Radio. Max Schmid, who's a good friend of mine, probably also knowing what my reaction was going to be, saw, what was it, like Valentine's Day in 3D? In 3D, where the head is cut off and it comes at you on camera and you see what's coming out of the eyes and all of that.
Well, you know, there are all levels.
Max loves this. Number one,
it depends, you know, and certainly, you know, when I saw the Omen, it was the only time I had ever done hash actually in my life. And let me recommend that if you've never seen the Omen, the way to watch the Omen is to do some hash beforehand, because wow, It did affect me. But that's
You're
my
talking
point.
About the Gregory Peck version?
Yeah, the Gregory okay. Peck version, the original version, you know, the guy
one.
Gets cut in half with the pane of glass. That was like, whoa.
Yeah.
But, you know, here again, it's all across the spectrum.
But you see,
it's
even there,
always...
it wasn't. I mean, that was like a visceral moment, and you have a similar kind of a thing in the not the Howling, or is it the Howling? It is the Howling.
Probably the Howling,
where somebody's head is cut off from a car window,
mm-hmm.
And that was a shocking moment. But you know what? The camera did not close in mm-hmm. to show us the process so that we could enjoy and love what occurred. It was a shocking moment of bang, and it's like, whoa, and I was taken aback, and I remember it, and it worked. What does not work is in Pulp Fiction to see the evisceration. Now, Quentin Tarantino himself recut that film mm-hmm. to be able to show it on TV, because that Pulp Fiction mm-hmm. is not a movie
right.
that in its raw form,
right?
And the word raw is really a correct term here. We don't need the evisceration. Just as Excalibur, a mostly wonderful movie, that has, it's very gamey. There's a lot of people being run through swords, including Arthur, in that, that's a spear. And we see the process of the spear going through his body with a blood-red sun in the background. That's still not gore.
It's a question of need versus want. It's,
mm-hmm.
you're saying we don't need it, but what does the director want?
The director can also show somebody taking a poo.
Well,
and to me, they're in the same category.
Let me ask you this. Let me put up an example
because
you're
here.
You know you and essentially you say, you know, well, I can't deal with pornography at all. Have you ever seen Don't Look Now, the Nicholas Rogue
yes,
film?
Yes, Rog.
Nicholas Rogue. I say, you say Rog, I say Rogue, you say go, I say gawk. But yeah, okay, Nicholas Rogue.
He says Rog, so I say Rog.
I'll respect that. Once again, because I'm terrible at pronouncing names.
I saw him on TV, he said Rog.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. But you've seen the film, you know that in the midpoint of the film, the couple... There is a sequence where the couple make love. It's a graphic scene.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I think, a tremendously... When I had seen it...
It's an erotic
scene. People argue with me. It's an erotic scene.
Yes.
But there are people who will say to that, well, this is a good film, but why is there all this pornography?
But there is, that isn't pornography.
You see, and here is the point. You see, here we get into the distinction between... erotica and pornography.
You know what?
And
a porn director can tell you the difference.
Well, and the Supreme Court can say...
I cannot.
Well,
actually, I mean, there's the famous quote,
yeah.
But that quote doesn't hold true. That quote holds true for erotic. It does not hold true for porn.
Here is the thing.
Where the quote, by the way, for listeners who don't know, was it... Thurgood Marshall? Who was it?
I think it was Thurgood Marshall.
I think it was Thurgood Marshall. How do you know that it was erotic? He said, it gave me an erection. That's the quote from the Supreme
right.
Court.
Here is my thing, is that...
And it's a good one.
And my definition is, I watch erotica. You watch pornography. Okay? And I think you're saying... I think you're saying the same thing with gore. You're saying that... There isn't a need for gore.
The purpose
in the film
in blue
and
is
my position is if the director decides that he wants to put the gore in the film, then that's the reason why the gore is in the film.
Actually, the reason that a lot of these people make their films is to put the gore in, and that's the difference. a porn director knows that he's making porn, or she's making porn.
Well, a horror director knows that he's making horror.
Oh, yes.
There are all shades.
But they're all horror. That's right. But there's a difference between The Haunting
and certain
and Freddy Krueger.
Yeah. And certainly, and I'm probably going to get his name wrong, Ira Roth, I believe it is.
I think that's correct. No,
the director of Hostel knew the type of film that he was going to be.
Yes, yes. And by many accounts, it's a very good satire and a film imbued with political meaning.
Yes, which I happen to concur with.
Okay. I think that that's an argument to be made. There's also, pardon me, any number of porn films that the same can be said about. Mm-hmm. There are porn directors that have tried to actually put story into it and make a statement in it. And usually the studios end up saying, you know what, we don't need the trouble. We don't need to pay the script writer. We don't need to do that. Just give us the money shot.
Give us the bump and grind.
Yeah, give us the bump and grind with the money shot and put it into a loop and move on to the next.
Yeah.
And I think there is no question that the director of Hostel knew that he was making torture porn. Or if you like, gornography. But that is the exception that I would say proves the rule. Because when George Martin, who's a person who's been on this program, when he lived in the New York area, was somebody who I liked and ran into frequently and talked about such things with. But at this point, both in the Fire and Ice books and in Game of Thrones, they say, what can we do to one-up Red Wedding? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they are thinking about. Not where will we take the Lankre family versus that family. That's secondary.
But that's...
What's primary to them is what's going to gross people out.
And I will hold that is a valid decision. I will hold that is a valid thing for a filmmaker to do for an artist.
I think that's the proof of how far down we have come.
I don't think so, because this has always been the case.
Erotica will always cause people to react to erotica the way they are intended to. Gore, violence, and that kind of stuff, that's not something you're supposed to feel.
I think it's a part of the art. I think it is a part... Let me drop the article there. I think it is a part of art.
And you know what I say? I don't say, don't make it. I don't say... I won't even say, don't watch it. I say, I will not watch it. And I have no problems telling people that I am squeamish, that I don't like it, and I will not see good movies that have it.
That's fine. That's great. You know,
That's my decision. I'm not saying you can't make this film. I will say it's a shame that a movie that I would otherwise enjoy resorts to that, making it impossible for me to watch Old Boy.
That's fine. You know,
the original.
All these years, I have been thinking to myself, you know, eventually, sooner or later, I should see The Passion of the Christ. There's a, you know.
Why?
Because there is this controversy about the film. Because there are people who do say it is an effective and moving piece of film art. I just can't bring myself to see it. I don't want to see that film. But I cannot then comment on the film. I cannot pass judgment on it. I cannot say, you know, and the term doesn't really apply in this case, but I can't say that it's gornography because I haven't seen it.
Well, it is not insofar as it is a depiction of what many Christians were taught is, you know, this is the suffering. My objection to the film is that there are also certain crackpot assertions put in there anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish.
I can't really address that. Because I haven't seen the film.
But that's my reason, and I don't have to have seen the film to be aware of... I don't remember now, because it's quite a few years, but I could tell you exactly what the issues were in the film.
Yeah. But that's...
I have secondhand.
But in particular, that's the reason why I sort of bristled at your applying the term gornography to Snowpiercer.
Well, the word that I saw was not pornography in any number of views. It was gratuitous. And the word gratuitous is, by definition, means it doesn't need to be there. That's what the word means.
That was the film that Bong Joon-ho was making.
It didn't need to be there.
So when's gratuitous?
When is gratuitous? When you have added something that's not even frosting. It's needless to make the point that the movie should do. It would be better art without it.
But you can
this
say...
Is, and by the way, the director isn't the only person. There's also an editor. There's also a producer. There are all these other people that are involved in the collective process. Sometimes...
Once again, I'm an auteurist.
Not every director is. Some are hacks.
Some are hacks, some get the film taken away from them by the producer. Some are under the thumb of a producer who think they are auteurs.
Some are replacing another director.
Yes.
I mean, what happens when Stanley Kubrick writes a movie and envisions it and dies and Steven Spielberg finishes it? Who's the auteur of AI? It's really a mixed-up issue.
No, Steven Spielberg is the auteur.
He tried to make a Kubrick film by his own admission.
It is not a Kubrick film.
The auteur
theory is not a perfect theory, but it is possibly the best way of analyzing
the best working
a film.
Analysis.
Yes,
I agree. I agree with that. But not every film has an auteur, which is the problem with a lot of those films. And very often people, you know, they say, well, that's really nice, Charlie, but we're going to do this. I mean, Blade Runner, a movie that I have a lot of issues with, and we're not going to go there now. But Ridley Scott did not put those voiceovers in that film, okay?
Yeah.
Who was the auteur there? Certainly wasn't Philip K. Dick, even though he's the author, because the people who wrote the screenplay never read a word that Philip K. Dick wrote. Is it Ridley Scott? Well, as far as the visualization and the genius of the film is concerned,
Ridley Scott.
Yes.
Ridley Scott is the auteur.
He is. But then is it Ridley Scott's fault that the movie is in many ways ruined by things like those voiceovers and the tributes to Alan Ladd that Alan Ladd Jr. wanted put in there to make it a film noir, which Ridley Scott never intended. He never intended it for it to be a noir film. And I have the recording of him saying Paul Wonder did that interview. Paul Wonder, that's a whole other show.
But I will hold the way we do a tribute to Paul Wonder on this program.
It really is. I miss him. It's like, 12, oh my God, how many years is this? Almost 15 years since he died.
And here I am. I come around and I don't like films, so...
But
I take issues with films other people like. What's wrong with me?
You're a critic. That's what's wrong.
I'm just a surly old cuss. Before we go, by the way, can I drop a few?
Yeah, because we're about done.
Okay, so let me just point out a few things here. One is that we are bringing back the CFQ Interview podcast, the the show where I interview filmmakers and stars for Cinefantastique Online. We've just started the most recent episode that's up now is an interview with Juno Mack, the director of the very gory film Rigor Mortis.
Sounds like a gory film, and from the title.
Coming up, we don't have it in the can yet, but it looks like it's going to be good, is Dante Palminteri, who's the son of Chaz. Commentary, and he's going to be talking about his experiences on Sharknado 2, the second one, and hopefully in August there is going to be another interview, and it's sort of up in the air at the moment, but I will say that to make up for all the time that we've been away, this is an interview subject who will be walking up to the mic and will be so important that the dead will rise. So, once again, the functional terms in that sentence are makeup
and dead.
Dead, walking. You figure it out. And we're trying to sync up that interview.
You know, I should have gone out with a song from the Zombies.
Yes, yes, exactly. And also, I also
that's
wanted...
another discussion, zombie films.
I wanted to point out that I will be appearing as a performer on The Dome, which is a podcast that John Drew is doing, a dramatic podcast set in a world where paranormal abilities exist and all these people are gathering.
You do hear the closing theme.
A giant megadome.
Right?
I'm getting out of here. That's going to be over.
Because I have to outro as well.
ChronicRiff.com. Okay.
Okay. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Dan Persons, which you didn't mention, for being here. And visit him at cfqonline.com. Visit me at ourwolf.com, although that's really stagnating a little. Go to Facebook is probably the best place. Join the Hour of the Wolf group there. New York Review of Science Fiction Readings is coming back with Walter Mosley on September 9th. Walter Mosley and Fred DiFilippo in a different venue, 388 Atlantic Avenue, having nothing to do with WBAI. We're just using the same building. I will be back next week from midnight until 3 a.m. with a Star Pit special, including the 40th anniversary of the Star Pit with Samuel R. Delaney, myself, and Lois Mingus. Yes, Mingus. Have a good morning. Take care. Be good to each other. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way. And don't forget to call 209-2950, area code 212, and pledge. Take care now. We'll be right back.
infernal. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it this cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea. Beirut, can't forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia. Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, east and south, central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
1995 Cinco. List alive. Bleached out that American flag. Bleached out that American flag on top of the Brooklyn Bridge. Eric Adams is an idiot. He's a P.I.G. I tell you how these people are. A bunch of opportunists. A work of art. A great idea. A thing that needs to be done. If it won't bleach, you burn it. If it won't burn, you drop it in acid. Burn, baby, burn. Clappers, that's what we do. Globalizing the desecration of the impurest red, white, and blue. Eric Adams, shame on you. 99 Cinco, list the light right here. The flag burning show will burn the imperialist flag to ashes with no apologies. Totally for political reasons, yeah. Brand new, Terry Wilson for you.
I know your sins, them are on. So carry we go home, carry we go home. And bring the Rona east. Well, come on a Rasta man. A Rasta no live on no capital land.
Oh, you mean?
And carry we go home.
Oh, you mean?
As every settle and cease. Well, come on a Rasta man. A Rasta no live on no capital land.
I am
well. America a capital, and the whole of Jamaica a capital, and a long time them won't trick the Rasta man. Like them no know, said that one a real African. You think me no member, King Ferdinand, and even Columbus have a golden plan. They make a brown turn and end up in Caribbean. One Rasta, they no side kill, enough Indian. And turn paradise in a plantation, and bring cross one ship load of African. Now here comes the thief in Queen from England. Now she come on well and Henry Maga. Century pant of a century full of separation. And after 400 years, me send a reparation. I know them want to kill me with the taxation. But I beg you, please take me to the motherland. I beg you.
Hey, back from the top. To the very last
and drop. And I said, I'm sorry, pandemic. Old slave driver, time is catching up on you. Old slave driver, I know your sins them are on. So carry we go
back from the tower to the very last
hour. Like dread and terror pandemic. Good God have grace, Lord will. I have His mercy. I'm the old slave driver. Time is catching up on you, old slave driver. I know your sins, them are on.
So carry we go home,
carry we go home. I bring the Rona east. Come on a Rasta man, a Rasta no live on no capital land.
Oh, you mean?